Welcome to the Adversity Psychologist podcast, a podcast incorporating narratives about facing and navigating adversity, a mixture of people, their experiences, and professional psychological discussion. I'm Dr. Tara Quinn-Tirillo. I'm a qualified and regulated psychologist with over 20 years' experience of mental health, disability, and human behaviour. I want to share people's stories of navigating adversity in the hope that through being heard, a dose of compassion and some understanding, we can help others in the face of adversity too. Hi, and welcome to the Adversity Psychologist podcast. Super sunny morning in the UK, but it is evening time for my guest today. I am super honoured to have Sarah Suzak with me. Would you like to say hello, introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about who you are?
Oh, fantastic. Thank you for having me. I'm very appreciative. I love the idea of community. I love the idea of sharing stories. So this is a real pleasure for me. Yeah, it's the best. But I'm Sarah Suzak. I work full-time as a corporate, executive. I'm general manager of legal and corporate affairs at a food manufacturing company here in Australia that has some pretty iconic brands. I don't know if you have them over there, so I don't think your listeners would know them. But I've also recently written my first book, Yuru, Find the Guru Within You, which we can talk about if you like. And yes, I'm also the founder of my own business, Medi Steady Go, where I teach a particular type of meditation to people. I do it internationally and locally. I do it online and in person. So, yeah, I found that as part of my story and my battles with health, which I'm sure we're going to talk about today.
And I'm so appreciative of you coming on because you have to fly somewhere super early and here you are last thing at night making time for my podcast. You have the most incredible, is not the right word, you just have an astonishing story. Can we start? Because that's the thing that caught my attention and has led you to write your book and do the work that you do alongside parenting, working, and all of the things, which also just blows my
mind. I know, I should have said I'm a mother of a beautiful girl, a nine-year-old girl, but I was just like, I've achieved this, I've achieved that. It's so tragic.
Do you know what? That's okay. I guess sometimes we go straight in with the, we are a parent, we are this, we are many hats, aren't we?
I know.
And it's lovely to be proud. As a woman, it's lovely to also be proud of those other hats as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
No, are you 100%. Comfortable telling us a little bit about your story, because you have been through so much and literally you are the essence of what this podcast is about.
Oh, well, that's a lovely compliment. But yeah, look, I have been through some very interesting challenges in the last 9 years. I was going through IVF at the time. I went through 9 rounds of IVF to get my daughter Stella. She's now 9 years old. She's turning 10. She's amazing. But about 1 year after she was born, and we'd been through all of that, which, I'm sure people know, IVF is, that was a challenge, but it was a worthwhile one. So we got our beautiful baby, and then 1 year after she was born, I got diagnosed with a very rare head and neck cancer, and it was a tumor that was inside my face, and it was attached to nerves in my brain, and was very urgent. So, we went straight into surgery. It was like a 19-hour surgery where I basically gave them approval to do whatever they needed to do to get it out. They were originally going to do open face surgery and open my entire face. It's a bit grueling, but they ended up deciding on the spot that they could cut out half my palate and enter through my mouth to remove the tumor more successfully. Right. And so they did that. They used the fibula in my leg. So they took out my entire fibula on my left leg, veins from my feet, skin from my leg, and they rebuilt my jaw with my fibula, and they used my leg skin to rebuild my palate. So my very strange, it's amazing what they did. But they did that, and they had great success. I obviously lost half my teeth, and I lost one nostril, hearing in my left ear, lots of different little bits and pieces. But then they did a lot of radiation, and that's where the real trouble started. That was extremely difficult, period. Yeah. But what they did was they burnt the bone that they put in there as the new bone. So I got bone death in the bone that they put in there. I still have it. So my face is extremely fragile, and I can't have teeth because they can't drill anything into it. So I went through all of that and then got through, we can break it down a little bit as we talk, but sort of 7 years later, I was in remission and we can talk about how I got there. But I got a metastasis onto my lung. It was a great news in the sense that it was just one metastasis and they said typically you would see a lot. I had very simple surgery to remove it. But 1 week after that surgery, which was very successful, didn't need radiation, didn't need chemo, I developed a condition called Guillain-Barré syndrome. And it was like my body just froze from the inside out. It's an autoimmune condition that they think that I would have got from a virus that contracted in hospital. But essentially I paralyzed with pretty immediate effect from the neck down and went on to life support for about 4 days. I think I was on life support. And then when I came out, I couldn't talk on my own, breathe on my own, and I just legitimately couldn't move from my neck down for many months. So I had to learn to walk again, talk again, swallow again, you know, the whole shebang. And that was only about a year and a half ago. So I'm here. I'm still standing.
Yeah. Talking about getting on planes and running business.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm here, I've survived, and yeah, I'm super passionate like you are about just sharing the story and what I've learned from it, and hope that might help somebody that goes through something as tough as that.
Absolutely. I think, and one of the kind of reasons that I started this podcast was off the back of the pandemic and kind of, there was a lot of panic and anxiety, but one thing I did notice is how much resilience we had, isn't it? And how many people actually were quite surprised about how well they coped. And then it got me thinking about the clients I'd worked with for 20 odd years. And sometimes we can go straight to books and support and not always maybe be so appreciative of what we have in us to face things that come our way. And I've had multiple guests on who've had adversity after adversity after adversity, and just what is it that teaches them? What do they learn about themselves? And for you particularly, just the first half of your story would floor most people, but having IVF, that's, do you know what, I've never had that on the show. I must do an episode
gosh, I could tell you about that.
Psychological and physical and the impact on relationships, that in itself is huge. To then have cancer, but then literally to be paralyzed and having to learn to walk, having surgery, it's incredible. When you hear yourself talking about it now, what tends to kind of show up for you when you look back at what you've been through?
It's so interesting because when I say it and when I look at pictures of people, I do a lot of speaking and share the story, and when I look at it, I just think, whoa, it's quite fascinating to me how I don't carry the trauma with me. So I don't have this.
It is.
And I would say that's not accidental. Like, I think I've done a lot of self-work to make sure that I rid myself of that kind of trauma and let go of that trauma, because I'm such a believer in, you know, the past existing fully in memory, the future existing fully in anticipation, and life unfolding in the present moment. And so right now I'm okay. And that's what I focus on.
And what you can do when you are okay. Because again, psychologically, that could really impact you to have adversity after adversity as well. Sometimes people can become quite hopeless, to kind of lose motivation for engaging things that can help them stay well. Are always really valid questions, because sometimes you know humans can get to the point of, well, what's next? What's the point in doing things? Because these awful things keep happening. But something has made you keep going. Yeah. Do you know what that is? Do people ever ask you that? What is it that helps you to just keep going?
I think I know this is going to sound cliched and like I'm saying this because I'm a meditation teacher, but it genuinely has been my meditation practice. I found it very quickly after I got diagnosed with cancer, and I wasn't a spiritual person necessarily before cancer. And when I got the diagnosis, I was extremely panicked. I've suffered from health anxiety, ironically, my whole life. Right. Very paranoid about dying and death, and these were all great fears of mine. And so this diagnosis just put me in the worst possible place from an anxiety perspective. And so
there is that absolute fear. Yeah,
totally. You're facing your mortality, like direct in the face. And when I got the diagnosis, I was told, you know, this is a nasty cancer, we can operate, but you'll probably only get another 5 years and then you'll likely die. Like, it was essentially what this specific doctor said to me at the time. And I remember thinking at that time, I really quickly moved from, why me, to what now. It was a big part of the shift that I made, that I talk about a lot with people, because I feel like the longer you stay in that victim pool, the more you're going to suffer and the less likely that you're going to be able to recover from what you're going through. And so for me, it was all about getting that clarity of mind through my meditation practice to decide what now. Like, what action am I going to take to get my power back? Because right now I feel completely at the mercy of circumstance. And that's just an awful feeling, because you feel helpless. And I needed to find my way to feel empowered again. And I definitely found that through my meditation practice, for sure.
That's really significant, actually, because sometimes people can get, again, very, you know, in a compassionate way, get very, very stuck on the kind of why me, what's the point? And that can be quite cyclical, can't it? But absolutely, that, you know, quite often in psychology work, we'll look at, right, sometimes we've got all of these things out of our control, but there will always be something that's in our control, and starting with that. And so did somebody introduce you to meditation, or were you reading a book, or was it just organic process?
It was total desperation after the diagnosis. I went straight into, okay, what am I going to do? And I was looking up books and topics and podcasts, and I just saw this guy on the Instagram that looked really calm, and I was the opposite of calm. And so I thought, I want a little bit of what he's having. And so I reached out to him as a total stranger. And then he said, he was in India. He was a teacher in Australia, but he was in India at the time with his gurus. And he said, go and have the surgery, go and do what you need to do. It's obviously urgent, but when you've finished, come and find me and I'll teach you this technique of meditation. And that was the beginning of everything. I did go back to him as soon as I was finished with my surgery, and I learnt. And then it became a dedicated part of my life and practice, and then I became a teacher. So, yeah, it's really worked for me in my life, without a doubt.
I do like those also, just, I don't know what you call those, sometimes I call them magic moments, sounds a bit cheesy, but that seeing that reel at that time, or reaching out to that person, and the fact of how many people might not reply on, in, you know, is 100%. That person took that time also to go, come back to me, genuine, you know, those connections. But genuine, the thing that I have my business partner, and I run a community project, is a mindfulness coach. She's beyond incredible. She's taught me loads. And one of the big things that I've learned is mindfulness isn't just, or meditation isn't something you just do, you know, you have to, it's a practice, you kind of embody it, you make it part of your life. And is that the journey that you've had as well?
Definitely. I think that a lot of people think that meditation is a technique, you know, and a lot of people do it, I feel, because it's a trend. It's like, oh, I'm a meditator, and it's got to be more than that. And I say it to my students all the time. I'm like, don't, and quite often I'll say to people, you're not ready yet, don't come yet, you know, because you've got to be, I'm happy to do that, because I think somebody's got to be really, my favorite ever quote was from Elizabeth Gilbert. I don't remember the quote, but I remember the sentiment behind it, but it was something like, the extent to which you will invest in a health holistic practice is directly correlated to the extent to which you're fed up with yourself. You know what I mean? If what you're doing is no longer serving you and you're completely miserable, you've got to really be fed up with your own shit if something like a spiritual practice is going to stick. And I was there. Like, nothing gets you down cross-legged with your hands in prayer than a cancer diagnosis, right? Like, I was motivated. So I do wish people didn't wait for the wrecking ball before they, you know, engaged in the practice.
Yeah. So kind of the prevention, incorporating into your life. And then obviously if you have things that come your way, but that's very, we are quite a I find over in the UK particularly, we're very quick fix and we're very reactive, waiting for stuff.
We want instant gratification. But it's I can say to people from learned experience, it is so much easier to find your inner strength and do all that self-healing if you don't have the trauma dangling over your shoulder at the same time. Whereas I had the cancer here and all the fear and the trauma that went with it, whilst I also had to find my inner strength. That's not easy. You're better off doing it when everything is going really well in your life. But unfortunately, the human nature is, no, life is good. I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing until, boom, the wrecking ball comes in and they're like, whoa, I better clean up my life. It's no, clean it up now. Clean it up before the shit comes.
People listening now, whether you're on a train, whether you're in bed, whatever you're doing, it's that, isn't it?
Yeah,
that kind of, what can that look like, that preventative model? It's not glamorous or sexy, I don't think. In the UK, preventative mental health work, emotional health work is always a bit, oh, whatever. It's a bit like we should go to gym a few times a week, but we'll wait for a holiday or
an event. Why do we put this off? Exactly. It's crazy. Exactly. Yeah. So I learned that the hard way. Yeah.
And like I said, that's what I really love then. Is it all right to ask, are there things, how do you know when someone's not ready? How do you kind of, what do you look out for?
When they're really resistant, like when they're saying things like, oh, I hear you, but there's just no way I'm going to find 2 20-minute slots a day to meditate, you know, or they're really questioning, and I'm okay with curiosity and I'm okay with resistance, that's okay, but when it's so strong and so palpable that you just know you're not going to overcome their, you know, in a way, false beliefs about what's possible. Because, you know, as I say to people, there are 72 20-minute slots in every day. If you can't find two of those that are just for your self-care, you know, that's something that we should think about, right?
That's a really good soundbite.
Yeah.
That's so profound.
Yeah. My teacher said that to me when I learned. Yeah, it's a good one, right? Because, and what I say to people is, think about it, if you need to think about it in a like a transactional sense as opposed to a spiritual, because you're not quite there yet, that's okay. Yes. But analyze it from a context of return on investment then, right? Like, start to become super aware about how you spend your day. And once you start to go, oh, I'm going to become mindful about what I'm doing with all the hours and all the 20-minute slots in my day, you'll realize how many of them you actually waste. If you're sitting there scrolling, or if you're just watching Netflix like this for 2 hours, enjoyable, and I love doing it too, but you'll realize really quickly, wow, okay, if I spent 20 minutes of this 2 hours meditating based on everything Sarah told me will happen if I start to meditate, would that be a better return on investment than 2 hours on, you know, like, what's the opportunity cost of not meditating, is what I'm trying to share with people that have that more transactional approach to the way they live their life.
So interesting, that transaction. So I went on a podcast fairly recently. The host won't mind me saying this, but the host had said, just as we were kind of chatting before we hit record, oh my gosh, you just made me, because we were talking about stuff and a book I'd written, I haven't done my meditation today. And I went, catch that. It's that tick box. It's a thing to do, isn't it? And it becomes a chore, which is why we, and that's exactly. What I just resonated with what you said then. It's about incorporate its values, its life, its connection. It's not just tick box.
Yeah, it's like, why are you doing it, you know? And what's it going to bring your life, and how is it going to serve you better than what you might be doing? Because I remember when I first got diagnosed, I went straight to a particular spiritual guru, a lecture. He was in town at the time. My friend invited me along, and I asked him, why have I got cancer? Why do good people get cancer? I was very much in that victim pool at the time. Yeah. And he just looked at me in the eye, and it's been one of the most profound moments in my life so far. And he said, tell me, has everything about the way you live your life since you got the cancer diagnosis changed? And I was like, I've changed what I eat. I've changed drinking alcohol. I've stopped smoking. I've stopped working till 2 a.m. in the morning. I've started prioritizing my family, and I've started meditating, all these things that I wasn't doing before cancer. And I said to him, it has. And he just smiled at me and moved on to the next person. And at the time I thought, are you saying that I caused my own cancer? I didn't ask him that, but I was thinking that in my head. And then when I walked away, I had that real aha moment where I was like, actually, I think he is saying that, and that's okay with me, because if it was my eating habits, you know, all the fast processed foods, if it was the alcohol I drank far too much of, if it was the work hours I did where I was in constant elevated cortisol and fight or flight, well, great, because that means I can change them all and prevent this from happening again. Versus, sorry, darling, you're just the victim of bad luck. What am I going to do with that? That will put me in the fetal position and not want to come out of my room. Whereas if he's like, if everything that you were doing pre-cancer was so good for you, why'd you change it all? That's what he was saying to me. And I love it.
Without
I
think it was actually great. Saying it as well.
Exactly. I mean, this is what good gurus do, right? They're pretty wise souls. So, it was a good moment.
With that, what meditation, what mindfulness is versus what it isn't. I always think that would be really helpful for people to know what it isn't. Is it all right to ask you then? Because I want to make sure I pronounce it right. Vedic, because you do a certain type of meditation that also caught my attention when we were talking about this podcast.
Yeah, I'm keen to hear what kind of meditation you do. But Vedic meditation is also known internationally as transcendental meditation. Okay. Have you heard the acronym TM, like TM?
Yes.
It's pretty famous. But it's essentially the same technique. So a lot of the Vedic masters from India were part of that organization, and then they broke away from that organization for whatever reason. And they teach the exact same technique, but they call it Vedic. And the reason they call it Vedic is that it came from a body of wisdom called the Vedas, which is an ancient Hindu body of knowledge that I've also studied. I've studied that for the last 3 or 4 years to understand more about it. But it's a very, very effective technique, and it's got a really high retention rate. And it's because most of the techniques that are out there, and so many of them are good, they're all very relaxing and restorative. But this one just takes it that step further, and I'll try and explain why. A lot of techniques require you to focus or concentrate on a body part or your breath or a candle or guided meditations, for example. I started that way and moved past them. But with all of those techniques, they keep you really calm for the 20 or 30 minutes that you're listening or staring at something. Yes. The minute you come out and you open your eyes, you're back in the chaos, right? And the other thing about them is that they're concentration methods. And if you're somebody that has an overly active mind or ADHD concentrating on something can actually elevate your anxiety. It can actually make you feel more tense. Yeah. So the beautiful thing about this technique is you get given a mantra. It's based on the time that you're born. It's just a sound that has absolutely no meaning whatsoever. So what your mind does when it hears the mantra and you're repeating it silently in your mind, it doesn't have any meaning. So your mind doesn't attach any associations or memories with it. It's just a sound. And what happens is your mind, which is so used to being obsessed with your compulsive thinking, starts to hear this meaningless sound, and it thinks, oh, that's a little bit more charming than the thoughts, this ever-repeating thought. I'm going to favour the mantra. And it just starts to go mantra, mantra, mantra. And then as you go deeper and deeper into your layers of consciousness, you come down to that state of pure consciousness where your mind goes, wow, this bliss that I'm feeling in this state of consciousness is even better than the mantra. I'm going to stay here. And that's the point at which you transcend your thinking mind. So it's not about controlling the mind or obsessively getting the thoughts to stop, because that's not going to happen.
Which is what people are still chasing all the time.
Can't do it. You can't control it. Like, real growth comes from not from trying to control it, but transcending it completely. Absolutely. And it's so
almost like
beautiful.
Making room for it. Yeah, dropping that battle.
Yeah.
And
it's pretty cool.
And as you said, that it's that portable. What I really love is that kind of idea. And I've always struggled with that. It's why I struggle with the idea of sometimes mindfulness in schools. It's you don't know people's individual kind of neurology, for want of a better word. You don't know. And some people really struggle. And that's why people tend to move away from it, because they're like, I really enjoyed it for 20 minutes. But then I was also thinking about the school pickup. I've got to do this and that and that. And then they think, I'm not good at it. The amount of times you hear that, I'm no good at that. I just can't. It's not for me.
That's what I get a lot of as well. Yeah. And I'm like, You've got to come and try this technique. It is so different. And the other thing is every time what happens is we spend most of our days, all of us, in the sympathetic nervous system. So we're pumped full of cortisol and adrenaline because we're just constantly in this fight or flight state. Absolutely. When you meditate with Vedic meditation, you de-excite your nervous system and you go down into the parasympathetic nervous system. And you reach that. Isn't it the most beautiful? Rest and digest, stay and play, whatever you want to call it. But what happens is then that activates that self-healing in your body. But what you're also doing is allowing yourself to sit in that state of bliss consciousness. And that state of bliss consciousness is filled with all of the qualities that we need in our life. It's pure calm, it's infinite creativity, infinite joy, infinite bliss. And every time you meditate, you actually enliven your intellect with more of the qualities of that part of your consciousness, so that when you go back out into the world, that part of your consciousness becomes your baseline dominance state of consciousness as opposed to the thinking state of consciousness.
So it moves completely away from that idea of I've loaded up my mindful app and we all know the key players at the moment. I've done it and then I'm back to exactly probably what state or more so
100% before I stick. And I get it. So people give up.
Not just doing it. That's to me is a big, because it's interesting. You said kind of what do I do? So I'm a big, I love the work of Kristen Neff. I love self-compassion, the science behind it. So I do a lot of kind of soothing touch, supportive touch for myself, activating that parasympathetic system. That's very much me. And I incorporate that multiple times a day. I do it in between clients. I do it between clinic and home and parenting and all of the things that come with teenagers. And that for me, so it's not kind of meditation as such, but that's my mindful. I'm much more mindful, especially at a big life change last year, and I pressed pause a lot more, but I noticed how much I was in fight or flight all the time. And you know, and our bodies aren't designed to be, you know, prolonged in that state.
It's like stress reactivity in and of itself is totally fine and necessary in the face of a trauma, like a saber-toothed tiger, like they teach you with fight or flight. But it's not, our body cannot sustain that level of you know, cortisol and adrenaline for the amount of time that we're in that state as everyday humans.
And as women as well of a certain age, so I'm of a certain age now where I also know I'm very mindful of how that impacts my body with what my hormones are doing at the moment. And again, it's the psychoeducation, it's understanding that as well. Is it all right to ask, so in your book, do you talk about, so this is something I would like, I've never heard of Vedic meditation before, so I was so interested to put you on. And it also aligns with what I do.
It's kind of like a practice that can be an adjunct to so many other different holistic health practices, like a lot of breath work, a lot of yoga, the self-compassion. I mean, the message in the Vedas, in these Vedic scriptures that I've been studying, is a message of oneness. So essentially the conclusion of these scriptures is that we are all one, that, you know, I'm sitting here and you're sitting there and it seems like we are separate human beings, and that is part of the truth, but it's not the whole truth. And the whole truth is that we all manifested from this field of consciousness and we never stop being connected to our source. So, you know, each one of us is really just extended self. So I found the message of love, compassion and oneness hugely motivating, and why the wisdom has resonated with me so much. But I do talk about the meditation in my book, to answer your question. You know, the book goes through, should I share with you what
I was going to say, because the kind of what made you, at what point did you go, I need to put something down on paper?
Well, it's really funny because so many of my friends have reminded me of something I didn't realize I've been saying all my life. But apparently all my life I have been saying, I have a book in me, I have a book in me. And I've never, like, randomly I've just said that without any idea for a book whatsoever. But when I was lying in hospital, that was pretty much when I thought, okay, I gotta, like, for me to think that that just happened to me for absolutely no reason is too much to bear. I need to find purpose from that pain. Otherwise, it's all in vain. And so for me, that was one of the things that I remember, like, I had the tracheotomy for long time, and I was having to handwrite everything. And during that time, I was so doped on, you know, opioids that a lot of it didn't make sense. But I did write a lot of book ideas, and I wasn't conscious that I was doing it because I was completely out of it. But I found them, and then I read the notes, and it just kind of tumbleweeded from there. But it took me a long time, like you were saying when we had a little chat before we started, that, you know, I was also very awkward about not sharing my story. I'm a share bear. I'm happy to answer any question. But it was more just, you know, my story's not, you know, there are a lot of people that have been through a lot of bad things. My story's not that special, and all these things we tell ourselves. But all of my friends were just saying to me the right advice, which is, hey, think of it as service to others. I know you, and if you if you're doing it in a way that's not to self-promote but rather to serve others, you'll write it. I know you'll be motivated to write it. And so once I shifted my mindset to, okay, this is going to help somebody that's going through what I've gone through, then it was easy. I'm like, great, that's what I'm doing it for.
And I'm also thinking whether it helps those people that are in the immediate circle of someone as well, to kind of give them that perspective or things that may be useful.
It is really funny.
Unsaid things, you know, that might be in your book that somebody who's supporting someone might not know.
Yeah, it is. It's strange, because if my family wrote a book, I would need to read it immediately to get inside their mind. Whereas no one in my family has read it. It's very strange. They just find it too traumatic. Yeah, and I get that. Yeah, I truly get it. But I wish they would read it, because it's actually a very happy book.
Well, maybe if they listen to this, if it's a podcast and you know, the talks and things, sometimes, you know, like you said,
Mom, if you're listening, read my book.
Read the book. And again, if there's little snippets that come out in podcasts, that just, again, it's dipping your toe in the water of that uncertainty, maybe, isn't it? It's been traumatic for them to go through. So, but what would make someone pick it up? What would make someone go, right, I need you, Roo?
Oh, gosh. I guess I wrote it. The reason I wrote it is it's definitely not a book just about cancer. My cancer story forms one of the chapters, and it's obviously a big central part of, you know, my own personal evolution and story. But what I realized when I studied the Vedas was, you know, they taught in the Vedas a lot about gurus, and guru in Sanskrit actually means remover of darkness. And I remember as I learned, that's the actual direct translation for the word guru. And I remember listening to it thinking, like, if there was a superpower that I could have right now, it would be the power to remove darkness, without a doubt, because it was felt like a very dark time in my life. And I wanted to get out from under those clouds more than you could ever imagine. And as I was studying and I was doing a course, it took me a whole year to do this course, I kept writing the word guru in my book, and I went back later and saw it. And what I meant by it obviously was, wow, the power to remove darkness is within all of us. And this is what I've learned from my studies. But how did I discover that? I only discovered that through meditation. And once I understood the concept of guru, which essentially is you acknowledging that you are the chief leader and proponent in your own life, once you realize that, anything is possible, and darkness can be removed like that. And but what I realized was, whoa, what have I been doing all this time before I discovered guru? And it reminded me that I had kind of been giving away my power for years to gurus outside of myself. So, you know, whether it was seeking my joy or my happiness from a boyfriend, seeking my joy or happiness from my family, seeking it from a job, seeking it from society, whatever it was. And so I started to kind of just document like each guru that I'd given away my power to and all of the things that I've learned from that. And so the book is really just about my own journey away from reliance on other people or other things to bring me fulfillment, and finding that fulfillment completely within myself. And so it's really about self-sufficiency, greater self-sufficiency. And I think that's pretty relevant to everyone.
Do you know, it's the essence of this podcast. That's almost the book of this podcast, isn't it? And I'm just thinking, as we're recording this, obviously this will go out in a couple of weeks' time, but there's a lot happening in the world at the moment. The news is saturated. I've already been having conversations with people about having media breaks. It can feel like there's a lot out of our control at the moment. Cost of living crisis, pandemic still, you know, impacting and so much going on, conflict and really that actually there's a lot of darkness. I'm seeing a lot more in my clinics at the moment, people really, really struggling.
I think
actually really good timing, this conversation today. That essence that sometimes we can just outsource everything. We've got a quick fix. I need this, I need that, rather than just taking some time to go, right, what have I got in me?
100%.
There's so much, isn't there?
It's like a reservoir of potentiality that exists within us, and we don't, you know, one of the things that I got told by a really amazing guru was, you like, he was Indian, and he said, you Westerners make me laugh so much because you go out there on these like search missions trying to find fulfillment out there, like and he goes, what you need to do is shift from being an importer of happiness from out there to finding it within, and then taking it to where it's not. And when I think about what it was pretty profound, and it's so relevant for me to what you just raised then around the state of the world, because I went and saw Marianne Williamson speak the other night at the State Theatre here, and she said, in a world where people are shouting hate, love cannot afford to whisper. And it's such a powerful message. Because she was basically saying, what is it that you're going to do? Because she said the reason that these terrorists and people like Trump and, you know, they're so successful at what they do is because of their conviction, their hateful conviction, right? What if we had the same level of conviction for love and compassion and peace and calm and joy? So it really kind of made me go, I've got to get out, I've got to teach more people, I've got to get this out to the world, because that's my way of contributing to more peace in a world that I feel like, what else am I going to do? What? How can I contribute to the opposite of what I'm experiencing?
And would you be able to do that if in the same way, if you haven't taken that time to just pause? And I'm going to bring something in here, because sometimes we can feel guilty, like we need to have permission to work on ourselves or put ourselves first. Yeah. And I'm also going to bring in the tricky thing as a mum sometimes as well, especially if you're a working mum or a mum that's doing kind of innovative work, you know, books, talks, it's quite, you know, you've got to get up in the morning, I've got to get a flight, I've got to get this podcast in around other things.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can feel guilty about taking time for yourself, but do you think you would be doing what you're doing if you hadn't taken that time to really almost like strip back the layers and go, right, who am I? What do I need? What's my purpose?
I certainly wouldn't. And this is what comes back to what I was saying, is like, don't wait. You know, I wish I had been living my life. My life is 1 million times better after cancer than it was before. And that's why I think people controversially talk about the gift of cancer, because it does wake you up. And when I talk about my story, I just want to make clear, I don't like to think of it as a story of survival. I like to think of it as a wake-up story. It's like it's time to wake up. And so, this whole concept of guilt, I have lived with that. I think guilt is one of the most common feeling that working mums have,
and
working
dads. It's always there.
It's there. But I always say to people, what kind of mother would you be if you don't give yourself care, self-care versus if you do? I am a 10 times better mother, wife, friend, co-worker because I meditate and because I invest so much time in myself. I've got no guilt about it whatsoever anymore, and that's quite liberating.
Absolutely. I love that idea you said before, so bringing in that return on investment. So rather than, I wonder whether that actually might help with the kind of guilt stuff that shows up, that, you know, it's investing in yourself in order to give to others,
It's not selfish. It's actually selfless. Self-care is selfless. Like, it's not selfish. You're doing it to improve yourself for the betterment of yourself and everyone around you.
And what I really love, so in terms of if people want to kind of find out more about you, you, as well as your book, you teach classes, but you also go around, you do talks and things as well, don't you?
Yeah, I do when I get invited, and I've been getting invited more since I've launched the book, which has been super lovely. So I'm doing a few talks for International Women's Day around resilience and presence and those sorts of really important topics. So I definitely do that. And, I've been teaching people meditation online. I've been doing it in person. I've taught a few people in the UK.
In the UK, are there rules?
Yeah, but I teach it online. So, Yeah, I'd love to. I've done quite a few people overseas and it works either way. But yeah, I would highly, I'm not a sales pitchy girl. I say this like from the bottom of my heart. It is number
Yes.
one. It is the number one best thing that you could do for yourself is learn how to regulate that nervous system and to transcend the thinking mind
Absolutely.
because it can really take over if we
You
don't.
think of everybody, so it's morning in the UK. It's only
Yep.
2 days since we've had a conflict erupt in the middle of
Yeah.
the world. Is there are a lot of people in this kind of fight or flight mode because of a lot of
Yes.
stuff on social media. So actually,
Yep.
even people probably listen to this podcast, and I can't imagine much is going to change in the next couple of weeks. There are a lot of
Yep.
people continue in this kind of fight or flight
Yep.
mode and probably don't
Yep.
even realize it as well. It's
No.
that taking the time. Sometimes we don't notice
Yeah.
until it dissipates how much
Yeah.
we live our lives in that
We live
state.
our lives. And it's
Yeah,
such
absolutely.
I think it was like Dr. Bruce Lipton. He's one of my favorite authors, but he said, I think it was 95% of all disease is caused by stress. That stress
Wow.
is the common
That's
denominator
staggering.
in all disease states. And it makes sense when you think about the harmful effect or the, because like, stress is like a physical activation in our body. Like when we're stressed, our bodies tense up, our heart rate, our breathing is quicker. There's a whole lot of physiological and mental side
Yep.
effects from stress that we're not conscious of. And the more I've learned about stress, the more I've realized that it's the number one thing we need to get manage, learn how to respond to it as best as we can.
So
Yep.
hopefully today, people, this moment, wherever you are listening to this podcast, I love for me that big takeaway of don't wait, that preventative model. You can go. Where can we find your book? Where do we find you? So if people want to find out more about what you do, if they want to find more about the Vedic meditation, where do you hang out?
Yeah,
Where
I
are you?
hang out. I've got my own website. I'm very excited by that. www.sarahsusak.com. Maybe you can pop that in the
I'll
notes.
put all of this in the show notes on your book and
Yeah,
where to
my book's
find you.
available on my website. It's available on Amazon. Got the typical social media, all of that, Sarah_Susak on Instagram, where I share a lot of my wisdom and just my inner musings. So some
I
people
love that.
enjoy
We'll be following this,
that.
having you
Yeah.
here
And
later.
but yeah, I'd love to connect with anyone. Not even to teach them, but just to connect. I love community. I love what you're doing. And
We were talking about before, valued and authentic connections. So everyone I've had
yeah.
in this podcast hasn't just been a kind of a passing. I really value the connections that I
Yeah.
make. And actually, for me,
Same.
kind of a natural next step, I'm gonna check out Vedic meditation as well,
Oh,
actually. Like,
good.
kind of
Good.
you said about timing. If I'd met you a year ago, I don't know if I would have been quite in the right place to do it, and it would have been more
Exactly.
hit rocks. Whereas because I've been
Exactly.
doing so much more targeted kind of self-compassion to parasympathetic work, actually
Yeah.
this is just how things work out, right? On this
It
Tuesday
is.
morning,
None of it's an accident, my
next
friend.
day.
None of it's an accident.
Yes,
Yeah, but timing
absolutely.
is, and that's what I mean by when I turn people away. It's just not the right time, and that's okay. Got
And
to
we
be the
do that
right
in
time.
psychology and therapy as well. That
Yeah.
actually, now isn't the time, and then that's
Yeah.
okay. I had, which is interesting, I'll
Exactly.
share this. So I had someone that came to me. I was trying to work it out about 10 years ago, who wasn't in the right place to work on something, who came back recently. And I just
There you
thought, wow,
go.
I'd forgotten all about it. And I do have
Awesome.
other people, and there's a shorter gap. But I thought, wow, that
That's
really shows
awesome.
you, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The way of the world. So I always
Yeah.
ask my guests my kind of signature move. And we've had
Oh.
so many nuggets. My head is just buzzing with ideas. But if there was one little adversity takeaway or one little nugget you could leave us with, what might that be?
Okay, I'm going to go into my reservoir. This is very authentic because we have not pre-prepared. So I'm
Yeah, which
thinking
that's
on
why I
my
love.
thing
I always
here.
just chuck it in there for people.
I know. I think I'll go with my favorite, mantra at the moment. I have a lot of things that I say to myself that really help me get through moments. And it's just very simple statement, which is to observe, don't absorb. I don't know if you've heard it before, but it is
No.
such a powerful statement. So when you're in a really stressful situation, whether it's a really stressful meeting at work or a really tense fight amongst your family members, just step
Yes.
back into the place of the observer consciousness and watch it
Yes.
play out and don't absorb it. Don't fall into the tumbleweed of all the emotions and storylines and narratives that go with it.
Which is, yeah.
Yeah, just observe, don't absorb. Try it. it might just sound like words right now, but keep them in your head. And when you're in a tough situation, bring them out and see what happens. Everybody I say it to just comes back and goes, oh my God, it works. It's a powerful way.
That's something you can do, isn't it, as well? That's something that you're in control of as well. Yeah. Especially for some people who, there's a lot about kind of unhealthy, you know, intergenerational trauma, narcissistic parenting, adults with narcissistic parents, that you can get very caught into things.
Whereas if you just kind of, detach from it, stand back, observe it, don't absorb. It's a little bit like when you meditate. It's like, you know, who is it that is observing the fact that I am anxious today or I am angry today? Yeah. What is the entity that is observing that I feel that way? That's your pure consciousness. And so what you want to do is try to live your life more from that place of the observer consciousness, as opposed to being caught up in this tumbleweed, this mind-identified kind of egoic personality.
Get rid of it.
Yeah, like it's, chasing, yeah.
Chasing the thing.
It's just a more lovely way to cruise through life.
It is. I think actually this episode's perfect timing. As I say, I took a break from recording, so we were going to do this last year, but actually sometimes things just have a nice way of working out. Thank you so much. I know it's super late there and you have to get up at like 4 a.m. So I am I'm so grateful.
Thank you.
Absolute pleasure having you on. I could talk to you all day. I have had quite a few guests that come back again. So
gladly.
More and more.
Good. Maybe, it would be my honour.
We will have a little rack our brains and see how we
talk
can do
again.
Some follow ons. Yeah, absolutely. Some of people get a flavour and they want a bit more.
Yeah.
But Sarah, thank you so much. Yeah, deep dive. I'm going to go and order your book. Famously say, that's my job for today.
Thank you. Thanks
look
for having
after
me.
Yourself. And I hope your trip tomorrow goes smoothly.
Thank you. All right, thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Adversity Psychologist podcast. I'm Dr. Tara Quintarillo, and it's been lovely having you along to listen to this episode. If you want to find more about me, you can find me at drtara.co.uk. So you'll see everything I'm up to, my media work, my collaborations, my clinical work, if you're interested in that. And of course, all the other episodes of the Adversity Psychologist podcast. If you're interested in coming on, you can also contact me and let me know what you would like to come and talk about. I'd love to hear from you.